This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
It is a pleasure for me to talk to Dr. Rick Perley from NRAO. Thank you very much for giving us your time.
Oh, very great pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And we'd like to talk about the VLA, which is currently undergoing a huge expansion. First, can you maybe tell us a little bit about the history of the VLA?
Sure. Well, the VLA is what we call a radio synthesis telescope. Unlike a traditional single antenna, it collects its information in scattered places by moving the antennas around. These data are all conducted electronically to a central processing platform, a large computer, where various multiplications and other manipulations are done. Ultimately, all these data are put into a Fourier transform operation, and out pops a map at the end of a long story, which replicates with the resolution of the full aperture of the distance between the antennas. This is a technique that was developed in many places, primarily though in England, at the Cambridge facility called radio synthesis. And it is a fascinating operation and a marvelous capability.
When was the VLA constructed?
So the VLA was completed in 1980. The construction began in the early 1970s. It comprises 27 antennas, which are arranged on, can be moved by large rail cars on a double-track railroad to 27 stations at one time out of a total of about, I think it's about 80, which are arranged on three tracks, which radiate in straight lines from the center of the array. Each of the arms is 21 kilometers long, so the maximum spacing, distance between any pair of antennas, is about 35 kilometers. And this gives you a resolution in this imaging synthesis methodology of about one arcsecond at 21 centimeters. So it's like optical quality resolution, but at radio wavelengths. And to do this, you need an aperture 35 kilometers across. You can't build an antenna that big, so we do it piecewise by pairs of antennas.
What were the initial science drivers for building the VLA?
Well, you have to go back to the 1970s and look at what was big in those days. And I would say that the things that the original designers were thinking of was neutral hydrogen from nearby galaxies. This was a hot topic, rotation curves, massive galaxies. Tracers can be done through the investigations of the motion of the 21-centimeter line from hydrogen. But at that time, they did not have sufficient resolution to resolve arms and star-forming regions, etc. So they needed an arcsecond resolution instrument able to do that kind of work. That was definitely one of the major drivers. And I would say that the other major driver was trying to resolve the structures of the distant quasars, the radio synchrotron-emitting radio regions from quasars and radio galaxies at what was then considered high redshifts of one or two maybe. And searching for these structures now known as jets, which were theoretically believed to power these large radio lobes from these central regions. These things were expected to be there. They had not really been securely discovered, although some early work done at Cambridge certainly indicated that these things had to be there. And so people who were designing and science drivers we're definitely thinking of this. And the array was marvelously designed for these two pieces of work. The correlator is a perfect match for local hydrogen in nearby galaxies, and the resolutions by the 35-kilometer baselines is well matched to finding jets in external quasars. So you can see in the design of the array what people were trying to do. And that was in the 70s, and now we're in a new era now, and the requirements have changed.
Yes. So first, I wonder about the VLA. It's a very versatile experiment.
Yes.
So the telescopes are actually movable. Mm-hmm. Is that to be conformed to different science drivers?
Yes, absolutely. And this, I must say, is although the VLA exceeds in all dimensions, and it was an absolutely brilliant piece of engineering, driven by brilliant people, who you must also say had access to sufficient funds to do the job right. Mm-hmm. You need all of these things in place to come up with the kind of order of magnitude improvements in instrumentation. But what they decided to do, and I was not, I mean, this was before my time, but what they had ultimately decided to do was to build a transformable array, one that is not fixed in position, but could be transformed according to what the science interests were. So we have with the VLA four specific standard configurations. There's these 80-odd pads that exist on these planes in which the array is built. And you could populate them with 27 antennas any way you wanted, but there are four standard setups, each of which offer a different regime of resolution. So the most compact, which we label with the unimaginative term D, letter D, is a maximum distance between antennas of about 1 kilometer. And it turns out that when you observe with your 27 antennas all packed together in this manner, you get a lower resolution beam, but you get exquisitely high sensitivity to soft distributed structures, what we call high brightness temperature. If you expand the array to the largest, you lose the capability of looking at soft, fuzzy, diffuse structures, but you enhance the capability to look at sharp, bright structures. If you're interested in both fluffy distributed emission and sharp, bright emission all in the same object, then you can observe with more than one configuration and then add the data together. And this technique works really well. So yes, this is a transformable array which has quite different science objectives between the shortest and the longest configurations.
How long does it take to go from one configuration to the next, and how many times per year do they change this?
Yes. So the configurations stay more or less fixed for 4 months at a time. There are four configurations, A, B, C, and D, A being the largest and D the smallest. And we go from one to the next one in about a week of time. It takes, actually, when you're only moving from, say, the shortest configuration to the next shortest, from D to C, this can be done in about 2 days. Because not all the antennas move. The way the array is arranged is that essentially every other antenna moves between adjacent configurations. So you might say the odd numbered antennas are the ones that are moved out when you go from the D to the C. However, when you think of this, you go from D to C to B to A. What happens when you get to A? Mm-hmm. Well, we don't go backwards, A, B, C, D. You take the antennas in the longest configuration and then move all of them, actually move all but three of them. Between the shortest and the longest configurations, there's only one pad, which is common. So 24 antennas have to be moved between the longest and the shortest, and they move a long, long ways. That one takes a couple of weeks of solid work to get that in. And then following the scheduled move, there's about a week, which is to make sure everything works right before you go onto standard configure and into a standard observing mode.
So I believe in 2001, people started with the upgrade for the VLA, EVLA.
Sure.
What was exactly the main reason to start this upgrade?
Two things, I would say. Well, there's a main reason, and then there's a main capability, you might say. I probably didn't say that quite right. What I mean to say is the science drivers that drove the design of the original array in the 1970s are no longer the primary science drivers in modern astronomy. Things have moved on. People are interested in different things. Thermal emission is a much bigger thing. Star formation, spectral lines, complex physics of star-forming regions, protoplanetary nebulae, things of this type. These do not figure. I don't think you even see it in the original documents for driving the design of the VLA. But now it's a much hotter topic. The other thing which is entirely different is the high redshift universe. Looking, say, large surveys for the signatures of early forming galaxies. These kinds of science requires access to much greater regions of frequency space, since you don't know where the spectral lines necessarily are going to add up or show up due to the redshift. The original VLA was a $78 million project, but in the 1970s, which is the technology that they had to use, they could not transport all signals from the antennas to a correlator. You could not build a correlator which would process all those signals, even if you could arranged to bring them from the antenna to the central station. So they had to make compromises in the 1970s, and they made very good compromises given the technology of the time. But since 1970 or 1980, there has been as everybody knows, an amazing change in technical capabilities. Receivers are better. Digital signal processing has improved by many orders of magnitude. The ability to conduct signals long distances has increased many orders of magnitude. So in the 1980s, and particularly in the 1990s, some of us were looking at what could the VLA do if we had access to implement or the ability to implement modern wide bandwidth, wide signal processing capabilities. Well, the answer was enormous great science could be done. The technology was there. The science drivers were there. All we needed was some money. And that's an old refrain, of course. There's nothing new about that one. We first tried in the 1980s to write a proposal to improve the capabilities of the VLA. That was not funded. It was well received, but there was not money. But by the 1990s, you know, as the science drivers continued to expand in terms of the need for more bandwidth, more sensitivity, more spectral coverage, more frequencies, and the technical capabilities to provide those for a very moderate cost compared to the cost of building the array, I think we were able to make in the late 1990s an excellent case for a major upgrade. And there was a big difference between 2000 and 1990. In the 1980s, when we were preparing this proposal for 1990, it was a limited upgrade. We were looking to expand bandwidths from tens of megahertz to maybe a couple of gigahertz at most, and a correlator that was a lot better, but not everything. But 10 years later, what I'm arguing is it probably is a good thing we didn't get funded for an upgrade in 1990, because by the 1995 and 98, we recognized that the only viable path, the best path, was not an incremental improvement, but to simply redo all the engineering, all the electronics. The only thing that's being transferred over from old to the new is a few of the high-frequency receivers, which themselves were upgraded in the 1990s anyway. So it's a complete rewiring of the array. The only thing, when I say only thing, it sounds like a minimal thing. We are retaining the antennas, the array configuration, and the support staff. These are major components. In fact, they're the most expensive ones. But the things that are new are all on the inside.
So it's mostly the hardware. Do the receivers themselves change as well?
The two of the high-frequency bands are being carried over from old to new, because they were already upgraded anyway. So they're new design receivers that cover wide frequency swaths. All the other frequency bands are being rebuilt with brand new receivers. And then there are two frequency bands that are brand new. We had no capabilities in those frequency bands. That's 2 to 4 gigahertz and 28 to 40 gigahertz. The VLA could not operate at any fraction of those bands. We will now have new receivers. Actually, they're both in place now, under construction, but some of the antennas are now outfitted, which give complete coverage within those frequency bands.
Is it possible to express the improvement from the EVLA, from the VLA to the EVLA in terms of sensitivity? Is there that you can say it's this time's better?
Yes, you can certainly do that. And I have, of course, in the various talks I give, I have a slide that gives all these improvement factors. In terms of sensitivity, it depends what kind of sensitivity you're talking of. Unfortunately, some of these questions don't have easy answers. In terms of what we call continuum sensitivity, that is, if you have out there an object which has emission which is about the same over frequency, then you can add up all the frequencies together to get you more sensitivity. So because the new receivers and the new correlator are capable of processing all the frequencies within any one given frequency band, we have a huge improvement in sensitivity, particularly at the high frequencies. Because at the high frequencies, say 40 to 50 gigahertz, where in the past we had to deal with only 50 megahertz of bandwidth, now we get 8 gigahertz of bandwidth. So that's 80 times the bandwidth. And since sensitivity goes with the square root, that's about an order of magnitude improvement in raw continuum sensitivity. On the other hand, if we're talking about line sensitivity, if you're looking for a spectral line, you can't simply add up all the frequencies because they don't contain the line. You're dealing with the bandwidth of the line itself. The EVLA does not offer a lot of improvement in that area because since it's the bandwidth of the line itself, it's a characteristic of the source, not of the instrument. We have better receivers, so there's less receiver noise, so you get factors of a few there. But to do better on lines in general, there's only one way to go, and that's with more collecting area. The VLA, EVLA does not offer more collecting area. So the improvements in line sensitivity are modest. It's an SKA of the future that will go for lines. That is outside our province. On the other hand, in the old VLA, the narrow tuning capabilities meant you could only get the lines that happened to be in that narrow section, primarily neutral hydrogen. In the new EVLA, you can combine all the lines that are within any wide bandwidth. So, for example, recombination lines of hydrogen. Within one band, there can be dozens of these things. With the VLA, you had to pick one. With the EVLA, you get all of them. And so instead of observing one line, you can get two or three dozen lines. And you can add those together. And in many cases, this is actually a viable operation to improve your sensitivity. So we can do that.
So in fact, it is a much faster machine. You can do much more science in the same time, basically.
Yes, this is absolutely right. The VLA has always been a fast machine because as a two-dimensional array, it can make an instantaneous two-dimensional map. This is a feature not early recognized in terms of its importance. Older interferometers, one-dimensional interferometers, like the interferometer at Westerbork or at Cambridge, they are one-dimensional, and you have to observe for 12 hours in order to get all the position angles as the Earth turns in the synthesis method in order to get a full image. The VLA is a two-dimensional interferometer, which means instantaneously you've got the coverage needed with some limitations to do a map. So that made it fast. It's also fast because it has 27 antennas. Fast in the sense that you can get to your sensitivity goal relatively quickly. Now, in the future, we still have the same number of antennas and the same array configuration, so we don't change anything in that way. But because of the extra bandwidth, we're faster in that sense because there's more information, much more information, 80 times the information coming in compared to the past.
And how do you deal with all this extra information? What kind of extra hardware do you have behind that?
I guess you've got to say this is a hierarchical business. We've talked so far about receivers, antennas, etc., which offer the capability to bring to the central processing area much more information at once. The information is digitized at the antenna and then put down optical fiber lines to travel the up to 21 kilometers on each of the arms to the central processing station. The central processing station is a very large correlator, and a correlator is essentially a large multiplier. This is an enormously fast machine because it has to handle 120 gigabits of data from each of the 27 antennas in real time. It doesn't store anything. It has to eat all the data in real time. This is large. It is not the largest in radio astronomy. The Australians are building a system called ASCAP, which has even a larger data rate than this. But it is large, nonetheless. The correlator is a very large and complex machine. It is being built by the Canadians in their correlator development group, which is located in the southern British Columbia town of Penticton. They've built many correlators in the past. They're a very skilled, clever group. This is by far their largest correlator. It is now just the design and testing of the correlator has been finished, and they're now building the final unit in Socorro, and testing of this is undergoing. Now, so this thing eats 120 gigabytes of data times 27 antennas. It does all kinds of complex multiplications and Fourier transforms internally, and then out comes a large data rate, which is typically tens of megabytes per second. Nothing like 27 times 120 gigabytes. This data rate must be stored in an archive. And the specifics of the archive are not yet completed. We will not be running at 25 megabits per second archive rate initially. Nowhere close to that. Probably one-tenth of that will be normal. And this can easily be handled in modern simple systems. Ultimately, this machine will run at 200 to maybe 1,000 megabytes per second in extreme situations and never full-time like that. That will be for special experiments. How those data will be archived and, perhaps more importantly, how they will be distributed to the users all around the world are issues not yet settled. There are lots of ideas, But we have to watch how the technology develops, how other areas, because this is not the only facility in the world that deals with data rates like this. There are many branches of physics, for example, that have such things. And we have to see how the technology evolves for this. But it is a problem we have to solve. We know that.
And for what time do you have to solve it? When should EVLA be completely online?
The antenna conversions are nearly all done. The correlator is partially built, but it's only a small fraction, a few percent of it. But by early next year, early 2010, all boards will be in the correlator, and it will potentially be able to run at whatever rate we think we're up to. So early in 2010, we will turn the thing on for science at a limited rate and in very simple modes until we feel our footing, you might say. And the rate at which we speed these things up is, there is a schedule, which is a very conservative schedule, because we don't want to promise people capabilities that we will not be able to support. I'm hopeful that we will go faster than that schedule, but the 25 megabyte rate maximum will probably be held for some time, a year or more, until we see just how it is that we need to distribute. I should say we're not entering a situation where we have no clue what we're doing. We have all kinds of good ideas about how to process this data, how to calibrate it, how to export it. The trick is trying to find the most effective way, and that we don't want to just blow our users out of the water with a giant data brick, which they have no way to be able to handle. We got to work in unison with our users. There's no sense building an enormous machine like this that no one can actually use. And so we're trying to proceed both aggressively and cautiously at the same time. I'm not sure how, if I was asked to explain what that meant, I'm not sure I could give you a rational explanation, but this is, we're trying to work with the users to make this thing work for them.
Okay, well, I'm looking forward to seeing the result of that.
As we all are.
So you're already a very experienced astronomer.
That's what some people claim.
Well, you most certainly sound like you've had quite an experience.
Oh, we've been in the business for quite a while now. I've been in Socorro for a long time. I was the first postdoc in Socorro. So when the VLA was being built, it started in the early 1970s. In 1977, I was finishing my thesis at the University of Maryland. My thesis was not build, but implement a new low-frequency facility that my thesis advisor, Bill Erickson, had built on a low desert dry lake in Southern California called Clark Lake. This thing, it was about a 3-kilometer wide T interferometer, an old-fashioned design. It looks like a letter T. Had some tens of banks of antenna wire grid arrays that we combined and multiplied and things of this type. But my job was to develop a synthesis method for using this and then apply it to looking at low frequency emission from clusters. The thesis was not, in terms of science, a great breakthrough. We ran into all kinds of interesting problems, but it sure taught me a lot about how to manipulate data and how to combine things and do synthesis imaging in a difficult environment. This must have attracted the observatory to hire me as a postdoc, because at that same year, the VLA was just beginning to come online. The VLA in 1977 is about in the same state in terms of development and bringing its facility into operation as the EVLA is now in 2009. So this was a wonderful opportunity for me because being, as I like to tell young people now, it's nice to catch a wave moving forward in the surfing sense. And the rise of the VLA, or another pithy little phrase, is the rising tide lifts all boats, right? So to be at the VLA when it was just coming online was a wonderful opportunity, because everything we did could not have been done anywhere else before. So we were able to, and I don't mean we, when I say we, it's me and many other people, because there were other postdocs there who came shortly after me, and many researchers from around the world. It was the place to be. It was a very exciting time. So that was in 77. And, well, now it's 2009. So what's that, 32 years later, and we're still there.
But with a much better instrument in the meantime.
Yes. So the early VLA was a very limited machine, and the correlator was, and especially the post-processing, was primitive, to give it the best phrase I can think of. And it caused enormous stress because the computing was nowhere up to the data rate. Horrible decisions had to be made about limiting data, and we didn't know how to calibrate it. We could barely make any images out of it. By today's standards, everything was crude, but the reward was worth it. And so it was long, hard hours at times, and you're always looking furtively in other directions to see who else was using up the computer around you, because the situation was quite limited. That, of course, with the revolution of bringing in desktop machines, changed all of that. And so the rise in capabilities of signal processing that comes with these things, better software, much better machines. Nobody worries about getting enough cycles anymore for VLA data. But, of course, with the eVLA, since we're increasing data rates by 2 to 3 orders of magnitude, we're very quickly going to be back just where we were in 77, at least for a while, until we can catch up. Yes. But I think we know a lot more now than we did then. We didn't really know how to calibrate. We didn't really know how to image. There was much discussion on the best way to do things. We're having the same discussions these days, but the knowledge base on which we are standing is much faster and much more solid than it was then. So I'm very confident we will much more quickly bring this thing up.
So were you always interested in astronomy?
No. Yes and no. I'm an observer by nature, and all my life I love observing everything, anything, and particularly weather. Since I was raised in northern British Columbia, and northwestern British Columbia, where weather is rugged and hard, I've always had a huge fascination in these things. And I had always thought in my own mind as I completed my undergraduate work at University of British Columbia that I would go into meteorology, and I had applied to meteorology schools in an eastern, let's just call it an eastern university, and had been accepted, but there was a small hiccup in that I was waiting to hear if I would get a government fellowship, because the Canadian government at that time, and I presume I still do this, were offering very attractive free, I don't mean free in the sense it didn't cost you anything, it was scholarships that gave you great flexibility, and you would not be dependent upon any advisor or university for funding. And this was very attractive. So I was waiting to get word on whether I would win one. While I was waiting, I got a nasty letter, what I considered a nasty letter from the university and the individual who had accepted me, basically saying something, we haven't heard from you, and therefore we are canceling your offer. And but that's almost the same day I received word that I had indeed won this nice government scholarship. And so I was able to write a similarly, what I thought anyway, in my mind at that time when I was young and foolish, letter back to the individual, essentially telling him where he could take his money. And I decided that instead of going to meteorology at this unnamed Eastern University, I would stay at the University of British Columbia, sign up with a new faculty member named Bill Shooter, who had just come in to establish a radio astronomy program. I had had a radio astronomy summer job at the Algonquin Observatory for the National Research Council in 1967, and that really dates me. But that was fun. I enjoyed that a lot. And so with a radio astronomy faculty member who was looking for graduate students, and I had the money, and my parents lived there, and I could stay with them and live cheaply, and so on and so forth. So that's how I got into astronomy. It was sort of a last-minute decision.
That's very good. Are you still interested in the weather? Do you still do some work on that?
I'm a fanatic about weather. You never leave these ancient loves behind. And I'm one of these tens of thousands of people who have a weather station whose weather information is uploaded every 5 minutes to the W Underground weather site. So if you go to your wunderground.com website and you type in Socorro's zip code in the upper left box, 87801, you will get the Socorro weather forecast. If you scroll to the bottom of the page, you'll see there's a number of personal weather stations listed links, and the one called Cayo del Lago is mine. So you can instantaneously see what the weather is in my backyard anywhere in the world. This is an amusing service. And as soon as I got my personal weather station, 4 people in my building also got personal weather stations, even though they only live a few hundred yards from me. Some of us are just incorrigible when it comes to this sort of issue.
But at least there's a lot of redundancy in the information then.
Well, it's actually interestingly different. One guy who lives only 500 meters away from me, but about 100 feet higher, you watch his weather station, which is the same as mine. So, I mean, these are well calibrated. These are very good instruments. And you will see in the daytime, his temperatures are the same. But at nighttime and calm nights, as you would expect, he's 2 or 3 degrees warmer. Mm-hmm. Just from radiational cooling, ground cooling. I'm lower, he's higher, and you can see the difference every day. Every day it's not windy, that isn't clear. Which in Socorro, New Mexico, it's clear almost every night. So.
Well, we'll put a link to that on the show notes.
Well, this is pretty ordinary data, and as I said, there are at least thousands, if not tens of thousands of people like me who have these personal weather stations. This wunderground.com, I don't know whose idea this is, but it is a very useful service. If you want to know what the weather is someplace that you're going to, you can go to any town in the world, type in the name of the city and its location, and it will show you the local weather stations.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for this interview. It was really great.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. It's a great pleasure to speak on these matters.